Welcome. Welcome. Sorry about the bells. They were, I didn't know the strategy entirely. Hello. I'm Alex Stenson, and I'm today's convener. I want to welcome you all to gather here today in the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. We are a non-creedal community interested in helping individuals find their ability to inquire into the world around them so that they may find the ability for faith in something sacred. We hope to create a space to ask the big questions, such as, what do we love? What do we hold sacred? What calls to us? How do we aspire to live? These are big questions that we may never solve here on Sundays, or in the whole of our life experiences. However, I hope the service today creates an opportunity for you to ask some of these questions of your own experience in the world. This community of seekers is here to share the opportunity with you. I would like to welcome you all, welcome all of you who have chosen to spend this time here in our community. And I'm seeing a number of faces I don't know, so I'm assuming other people don't know each other. So what I would suggest is to extend a warm hand to some of your neighbors and welcome them and introduce yourself. So, I'm glad to see that everyone's so excited to introduce themselves. It's such a great community that we have here, that we have so much conversation and sharing just from the beginning of the service, even though it's 10:45 on a Sunday, and we could be sleeping in. So we start our service with the lighting of the chalice. The chalice is a symbol of the gathering together here for worship as a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. And so I'm going to start with a reading and then light the chalice to symbolize that gathering. So, come we now out of the darkness of our unknowing, in the dusk of our dreaming. Come we now from far places. Come we now into the twilight of our awakening and the reflection of our gathering. Come we now all together. We bring unilluminated our dark caves of doubting. We seek, unbedazzled, the clear light of understanding. May the sparks of our joining kindle our resolve, brighten our spirits, reflect our love, and unshadow our days. Come we now enter the dawning. As we start our service, I'd like to invite you to join us in singing from the Dark Blue Hymnal, number 349, We Gather Together.
Sing of him.
Thank you. So now is the time of the service where we have announcements. No one came to me beforehand, but I would like you to turn your attention to the announcements in our program, the calendar on the back side of activities, as well as the normal scheduled events, including two Unitarian Universalist theology opportunities with Reverend Michael. So we have reached the time in our service for the joys and concerns section. For those of you who are new to the community here, this is where we rise up as a community to revel in those experiences that you find meaningful and bring you joy, and help uphold your strength when you have experiences that create hardship in your lives. So if you'd like to share in either of these opportunities, a joy or a concern, with the congregation, it'd be great. Towards the back there.
Thank you.
Hi. Hello. Is that going through? Can people hear me?
Closer to your mouth.
This way?
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to share a joy. I recently got a newer car. You know, I had a 14-year-old one that had 215,000 miles and was able to get a newer car. So I just wanted to share that.
Other joys and concerns?
Okay.
I give the mic away. Now I'm taking it back. it's my real joy today, an event just commencing in the other Manhattan, that other one, the People's Climate March. And I'm very excited about that. I have my brother and a niece are there marching today. And it is my hope that this will be a turning point. We can hope, can't we?
Yeah, we can. Other joys and concerns?
I guess that's it.
Well, thank you for everyone that has shared and the opportunity to share the joys and concerns. When we all hold joys and concerns within our lives that we didn't share, and I'd like to just take a moment of thought and reflection on what we're what you revel in and what challenges you're facing in your own lives. And with the power of that reflection, I want to turn to opportunity to share and learn about the world with the story for all ages. So if all the children would like to come up. Hi. Do I have all the young ones? Cool. So I'd like to open our story for all ages with a question. And that question is, what is fear? Anyone have any ideas? What is fear? Yeah.
Fear
is what?
Danger.
Fear is danger. What is fear for you?
Fear for me is like when you're scared or worried or...
Yeah, fear is scared and worried. Anyone else have any ideas of what is fear? Well, I have a definite... Oh, do you have an idea?
Fear is something that you're not comfortable around.
So I think that idea of discomfort is a really good place to start when we think about fear, right? Fear, and this is the definition I found, fear is the feeling that you have when you enter a situation, and you feel a bunch of uncertainty, right? So you're not comfortable. You don't quite understand what's going on around you, and so you feel fear. about how that situation is going to affect you. Maybe it makes you timid or shy or maybe a little scared, right? You know, you cower a little bit because you don't know what the options are, how that opportunity is going to change. So today, Reverend Michael is talking to the congregation about how we use our power of choice to overcome situations that cause fear through a willingness to have faith in the opportunities created by those fearful situations, how we can learn, how we can gain access to understanding. So to think a little bit about this, I wanted to share a part of the novel Alice in Wonderland. Do you guys know the story of Alice in Wonderland? Yeah? Yeah, you've probably seen the Disney movie, right? Yeah. Well, you haven't. Oh, you haven't either. Well, you know, good thing I have a little bit of a summary of the story here. She has, but she doesn't remember. So you know what? I'm going to remind everyone exactly how the story of Alice in Wonderland starts. So the story of Alice in Wonderland starts with a girl, Alice, right? And she gets lost in a world full of talking creatures, crazy experiences, misadventures, her imagination. What? Weird stuff. Lots of weird stuff. Yeah, Alice in Wonderland. And more importantly, in the first couple chapters of this witty little novel, Alice is magically transformed from big, really big, right, to really small, and then really small to really big again. And she's thrust in a number of situations where she's unfamiliar and becomes fearful, right? She gets a little bit scared because all these things are changing, right? And that change is really scary. And she endures several of these disorienting events where she learns to interact with a number of different types of creatures. One of these creatures she encounters is the caterpillar. Do you guys remember the caterpillar? He's hilarious. Yeah, he is quite funny. I think, well, and that's part of the reason I chose the story, right? And I find her encounter with him to be a good example of how we can handle fear, right? With a bit of faith in ourselves and the world around us. So here's an edited version of Alice's encounter with the caterpillar. As a note for all of you who know the story, I've foreshortened it with the removal of a hookah and one of Carol's silly interjections and nonsense stories. So those aren't going to be included. Alice came upon the caterpillar, and the caterpillar and Alice looked at each other for some time in silence. At last, the caterpillar addressed her in a sleepy voice. "Who are you?" said the caterpillar. This was not an encouraging opening for a conversation. Alice replied rather shyly and fearfully, I hardly know, sir. Just at present, at least I know who I was when I got up this morning. But I think I must have been changed several times since then." This was not in an... What do you mean by that?" said the caterpillar sternly. "Explain yourself." I can't explain myself. I'm afraid, sir," said Alice, "because I'm not myself, you see." "I don't see," said the caterpillar. "I'm afraid I can't put it more clearly," Alice replied very politely, "for I can't understand it myself to begin with, and being so many different sizes in a day is very confusing." "It isn't," said the caterpillar. "Well, perhaps you haven't found it so yet," said Alice, "but when you have to turn into a chrysalis, you will someday, you know, and then after that into a butterfly, I should think you feel it a little odd, won't you?" "Not a bit," said the caterpillar. "Well, perhaps your feelings may be different," said Alice. "All I know is I would feel very odd to me." Yeah, wouldn't it be odd to change all that in a day, right? "You," said the caterpillar contemptuously, "who are you?" Which brought them back to the beginning of the conversation. Alice felt a little irritated. Yeah, it's kind of silly, right? After he stared at her without speaking, he unfolded his arms and said, "So you think you've changed, do you?" "I'm afraid I am, sir," said Alice. "I can't remember things as I used to, and I don't keep the same size for 10 minutes together." "What size do you want to be?" it asked. "Oh, I'm not particular as to size," Alice hastily replied. "Only one doesn't like changing so often, you know." Yeah, changing, weird. "I don't know," said the caterpillar. Alice said nothing. She had never been so much contradicted in her life before, and she felt she was losing her temper. "Are you content now?" said the caterpillar. "Well, I should like to be a little larger, sir, if you wouldn't mind," said Alice. 3 inches is such a wretched height to be." "It is very good height indeed," said the caterpillar angrily, rearing itself upright as it spoke. You know the caterpillar was exactly 3 inches high. "But I'm not used to it," pleaded Alice in a piteous tone. And she thought of herself, "I wish the creatures wouldn't be so offended." "You'll get used to it in time," said the caterpillar. And then after a few minutes of reflection and contemplation, "One side will make you grow taller, and the other side will make you grow shorter." "One side of what? The other side of what?" thought Alice to herself. "Of the mushroom," thought the caterpillar. Said the caterpillar, said just as if she had asked it aloud. And turning, and in another moment, the caterpillar walked out of sight. Alice remained looking thoughtfully at the mushroom for a minute, trying to make out which were the two sides of it, and it was perfectly round. She found this a very difficult question. Round mushroom, taking two different sides. How do you decide what side is a mushroom? It's crazy, right? However, at last, she broke off a bit of the edge with each hand. "And now, which is which?" she said to herself, and nibbled a little of the right-hand bit to try the effect. The next moment, she felt a violent blow under her chin. It had struck her foot. Struck? It hit. Her foot hit her chin. Can you imagine that? Yeah, crazy, right? Yeah. Her chin, she was a great deal frightened by this very sudden change, but she felt that there was no time to be lost, and as she was shrinking rapidly. So she set to work at once to eat some of the other bit. Her chin was pressed so closely against her foot, there was a hard time to open her mouth. Can you imagine that? Your foot up against your mouth trying to eat? But she did it at last and managed to swallow a morsel of the left-hand bit. And the next moment, she realized she had grown again. So, that's the end of the section of the story I pulled out. And it's a really interesting story, right? Because Alice handles a number of disorienting moments in the story. First, she doesn't know how to approach the caterpillar, right? Really confusing. Who are you? Right? That's kind of a weird experience. Yeah? Have you ever been just asked over and over again, "Who are you?" No? Why not? Yeah, you barely see someone as new, and once someone knows you, they know who you are, right? And then she gets frustrated and intimidated by the conversation. It's a weird conversation. Kind of crazy, right? And then she doesn't know how the mushroom will affect her, what choices we make. But throughout, she continues to choose to participate in the situation at hand with the best of her ability, not hiding or running away because she fears what is next or doesn't understand what will follow. So she just has a little bit of faith in the situation, right? Instead, she chooses to have a little faith and willed herself to endure it. And look what she got. She grew a little bit bigger. Yeah? So she trusted the situation, and she paid attention, and she got a little bit bigger. You guys are all starting to get impatient. So thank you for listening to the story. I hope you have a lot of fun in RE today. And I hope that any fearful experiences you have in the next couple of weeks, that you trust yourselves and the world around you to make those situations better. Yeah? Trust in that fear. So, yeah.
"As far as our hearts go with you, go in the way our hearts go to. Learn in love and go in wisdom. Shine in the light in all you do. Go and love, our hearts go with you. Go and joy, our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do."
So, now is the time in the service where we do the offertory. Renee is going to be playing Henry Mancini's Moon River. Thank you. Thank you. That was a really touching piece. So I have a few musings to introduce Reverend Michael, who's going to be doing the rest of the main chunk of the service today. When Michael asked me to convene his service today, he threw out a few words that started as a mystery to me. Willing, choosing, prayer. These words seem to be a bit of a contradiction, for often I thought of prayer as an act of projecting oneself away from this world in order to cede your will and choice to something arbitrarily outside. But as I talked with Michael, I realized that he meant something altogether different than what I heard him say at first. Not only should we commit to choice in the sense of free will, that individuality should allow us to be willing and choosing of our opportunities and fate. But also we must find the ability to be completely willing to lose ourselves into a moment, experiencing the moment and the causes for it. In a way, the ceding of ourselves to a moment becomes an act of prayer. We must find the ability to pray to something beyond oneself, perhaps not godlike, but simply to the rest of existence that brings forward these experiences of uncertainty and created fear, as I was kind of talking about with the children. This prayer opens us up to the opportunity for faith, particularly in a faith that serendipity will intervene and create opportunity for a better us, to create a self transformed by experiencing moments of uncertainty that create that fear, instead of those moments tearing us apart, creating, you know, a fractured self. I didn't really begin to understand these ideas until I found this profound little poem by A.R. Ammons when preparing for the service. It's titled Figuring Belief. Praying answers prayer. In the deep spells of inquiry and hope, a self enabled to rise again to the compromises and the shattering caring forms. As Ammon puts it, a self forms out of praying. Praying answers prayer. So, with those few words from Ammon and musings from me, I hope they provide a good platform for us to welcome Reverend Michael to exploring the idea of willing and choosing, especially as that has to do with the community we have here.
Good morning, everybody. This last week, I had the pleasure of visiting Les Frazier. Many of you may not know him, but he's 94. He's been a stalwart individual of this fellowship for many years. He is mostly confined to a bed at Meadowlark, but his questing spirit continues as he continues to ask deep questions about what does it mean to be a person who's going to die? And what does it mean to be a person who still hopes to live? So when I walked in, well, he was busy in the bathroom, so I had to leave and come back. And then the aide said that he's ready to visit now, and I was able to see Les get himself out of the wheelchair and literally climb in the most torturous way imaginable onto the bed, pulling himself up, willing himself to get into bed. So once he was settled, and, well, he never is quite settled, so we started talking, I have to get my hearing aids. So he's got his hearing aids in a mason jar with a bunch of pens and rubber bands and paper clips, and so that all has to come out. And he gets his hearing aid on, And then he looks at me and says, so what's new? And I said, oh, well, I got a question for you, he said. He said, do you know what I did? And I said, no, Les, I don't know what you did. I got a tattoo. I said, no, Les, you didn't. He said, yes, I did. And so he showed me that tattoo on his arm. He went to Crazy Cats in Aggieville, and he got a tattoo. And he said, it says, "Life, live life now, savor moments." He said, I should have gone for the more expensive package, because I really would have liked it to say, live life now, savor every moment. So here is a man who can barely get up and move around, still finding a way to live his life. An act of will is not unlike prayer. Les has tattooed a prayer of affirmation on his arm, one that also hints at petition and would become one by saying, may I live life now and savor every moment. Some of us recoil when the word prayer is used. It implies to many progressive people a belief in supernaturalistic religion. Here's a prayer attributed to Socrates. Beloved Pan, and all ye other gods who haunt this place, give me beauty in my inward soul, and may the outward and the inward man be at one. May I reckon the wise to be wealthy, and may I have such quantity of gold as none but the temperate can carry. Socrates' prayer helped him approach life with a freshness of wonder. He never lost his joy in living, the sense of that this life is a gift you should be grateful for and carry forward with as much joy as possible. You may think, well, that is all in fine in ancient Greece, where we imagine Socrates engaged in lively dialogue with people he was mentoring or friends he was talking to in the square. But he also lived in very difficult times, threatened by destruction, when things were changing very fast. In old age, he was put on trial for corrupting the youth, in part for denying God's existence. Yet he could offer his voice up to the call to fill his life with beauty, inwards and outwards. He understood that this was a way that he could choose to control his life. Reverend Harry Schofield, a mentor of mine in seminary, believed that our essential character is revealed by our prayers. He taught sacred texts. He taught by not pushing wisdom on us, but by inviting us into the reality of the words that were written sometimes 3,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 500 years ago, so that we could have a real relationship with those words and how they might impact how we live our lives today. So it's never force-fed. It was never memorize this Bible passage or memorize this from an Egyptian sacred text. Understand it. Understand it. Take the time to move into its reality. He would say to you today, if the word prayer makes it difficult for you to listen to me talk about it, please replace prayer with your deepest wishes and most sincere longings. These yearnings that may issue from the unconscious realm of our being that call us into a cosmos, sometimes for understanding, sometimes asking for help. Jose Ortega y Gasset, professor of psychology, logic, and ethics, a professor of metaphysics at the University of Madrid, was most famous for his essay, Revolt of the Masses. He believed and taught that you must leave behind prejudices no matter how well they might be formed. Leave behind your prejudices. He wrote, "There is a true religious attitude at the center of the urge to understand. When I get up in the morning, I recite a brief prayer, 1,000 years old from the Rig Veda, which contains a few winged words. Lord, awaken us in a happy mood and give us to knowledge." We have the power to shape the nature of our longings. As one matures, a lifelong process, one becomes increasingly responsible for the core values and the meaning they provide. When we are too busy in this age of constant distraction, we often neglect the tending of our inner lives. We're too busy, or it hurts too much. But we need to do so and assume with responsibility the intelligence, grace, and dignity that come from seeking. How does one persevere in their search for inner beauty at the age of 94 or 14 or 98? Whatever age you are, how is that done? Of course, it's different for everyone. A tattoo? Well, if it helps you every day when you're lying there feeling alone and in pain, to savor even that moment, that's a way. How is it that we can careen from feeling like on top of the world, we're in charge, everything's going our way, to the next day when we feel like we just have no rudder, we're going in the wrong direction, everything feels like crap? This happens, doesn't it? One day you feel great, the next day you're feeling like, oh, I have to get through this day. We all go through those changes, those wild vicissitudes. Why do some days fill us with a sense of our potential and good self-regard, to the next day feeling downtrodden? Reverend Schofield Gasset believed that of primary importance is our posture to the day as it begins, to our universe and to ourselves. Harry had an amazing contemplation practice. Every morning, he would get up at dawn, and if the weather permitted, he lived in the Bay Area, so it often did, he sat in the garden with a cup of herbal tea and would commit to memory a poem or a passage from a sacred text. And then throughout the day, he would take time to ask himself, what was that I was saying this morning at 5 o'clock? How does it resonate now? Am I listening or am I distracted? Am I in the flow or am I out of the flow? He used that morning time of contemplation of a great poem or sacred text to bring him deeply into the center of his existence so that he could live authentically. His was a habit of cultivating the heart so that it could be receptive to the authentic power of love and how it could shape one's thinking and being in the world, to inspire himself to use his gifts wisely. He believed that true strength begins when we learn that within us there are potentials for growth, resources of the mind and the spirit that are innate to each of us, and it is our calling to become fully realized, to uncover, discover, open up, and to nourish these abilities. His morning practice cultivated an amazingly strong and enduring relationship with wisdom that he freely and compassionately shared with whoever was interested. The psychologist Abraham Maslow believed that this connection to our inner nature is often weak in the United States. And even so, it persists underneath the surface, unconsciously, often denied and repressed by all kinds of factors, like the voice of the like that voice that tells you no, 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 instead of yes, yes, yes. So instead of having a positive attitude in the morning saying, help me wake up to what is good and beautiful, some people wake up and say, like my father, excuse me, oh shit. But that's how he felt when he woke up, because his body hurt and he had to get up and work hard. He was a hard physical worker. So getting up meant that he had to leave that resting place. But it wasn't necessarily the best attitude. We found it funny, but anyway. Maslow believed that the inner nature of human beings is inherently good, but it is subject to sickness and distortions and oppressive stresses that life places on us. He believes that our innate need for beauty is weaker than certain instinctual needs, but never disappears. Our inner intentionality, he believed, is stubborn. It has 9 lives. It keeps on pushing up against the barriers until it can emerge, like the new green growth after a forest fire or an eruption of a volcano. Here are 5 assumptions that Maslow makes about this. We have, each of us, an essential inner nature, which is to some degree natural, intrinsic, given, and in a certain sense unchangeable, or at least unchanging. 2, each person's nature is in part unique to the self and to the part species-wide. It is possible to study this inner nature scientifically and to discover what it is, but not to invent or to discover. The inner nature, as much as we know about it, seems not to be intrinsically evil, but rather neutral or positively good. What we call evil appears most often to be a secondary reaction to frustration of the intrinsic nature. 5, since the inner nature is essentially good rather than bad, it is best to work with bringing it out, encouraging it, rather than suppress it. If our innate goodness is allowed to flourish, it can guide our life in ways that helps us to grow in healthy, productive, and peaceful ways. Maslow was very careful to underscore how important it is for us to recognize vividly and poignantly, each for oneself, is that every falling away from species virtue, a sense that we are innately good, every crime against one's own nature, every evil act, everyone without exception records itself in our unconscious and makes us despise ourselves. So every act that we do that goes against our nature, the sense that we're good people and can be productive and contribute to beauty, gets recorded in our subconscious, unconscious realm. Thus, we find people running from themselves, relying on patterns of self-deception to give themselves the illusion that they are being fulfilled. We all know what this is like. We all do this every week. It's impossible not to. But our job as people who are thoughtful and want to grow into our fullness is to take the time to stop, check in. Am I in sync with what is most true to me, or am I out of sync? You can get the gist of Maslow's 5 statements in the traditions of religious humanism, framed differently, but essentially the same. In Buddha's words, be ye lamps unto yourself, be your own radiance. Hold to the truth within yourselves as the only lamp. In Hindu literature, we find, thou art the path and the goal that paths never reach. Thou feedest or sustainest all that human sees or seems. Thou art the trembling grass and the tiger that creeps under it. Thou art the light and the sun and moon, the sounds fading in silence, the sanctity of sacred books, the good that destroys evil. In the Old Testament of the Bible, in Jeremiah, there is this: then I said, I will not make mention of him, nor speak any more his name, but his word was in my heart as a burning fire. This was a quote that fired and gave real direction to Martin Luther King Jr.'s work during the civil rights. So he drew upon this text often. The inner reality from which over time we find ourselves called to act for good was described by Oscar Wilde as humility, which is not something you usually ascribe to Oscar Wilde, who was one of the best raconteurs of the 19th century, known for his ribald witticisms, his ability to turn things on his head. He wrote, now I find hidden somewhere in my nature something that tells me nothing in the whole world is meaningless, and my suffering least of all. That something hidden away in my nature, like a treasure in a field, is humility. That something hidden away in my nature, like a treasure in a field, is humility. Wilde had just finished serving 2 years in prison. He was tried for daring to love men. He was known for the phrase, love that dare not speak its name. Wilde managed to secure a mistrial during the first of his trials, although many of the potential witnesses refused to betray Wilde by testifying, he was convicted. The judge remarked at his sentencing, it is the worst case I have ever tried. I shall pass the severest sentence that the law allows. In my judgment, it is totally inadequate for such a case as this. The sentence of the court is that you will be imprisoned and kept to hard labor for 2 years. So after all of the glamorous life was taken away from him and he had spent 2 years in hard labor in prison, he moved to France and lived a pretty desperate life. But at the center of that desperation, he kept on seeking meaning. And where he found it finally was with humility, which essentially means that you're able to recognize your oneness with all human beings and their suffering and their joys. The impulse for good finds its way into the world sometimes in unexpected ways. When I was in my mid-20s and my life was kind of going in the wrong direction, I decided to leave Kansas and to move to San Francisco. But before I did that, as people in their 20s are off to do, I took an 800-mile trip east to Chicago before I went west. I wanted to visit my grandmother, who was 84, who had always been very dear to me, and I had a number of double cousins, twins married brothers. We lived in identical houses next door to each other. It's like a crazy, crazy Stephen King novel. But one family was like the black sheep and the other was the white sheep. Anyway, my double cousin Patty, who was close in age to me, was married, was 5 months pregnant, and in the second week that I was visiting, she fainted at work and was rushed to the hospital. She had severe diabetes. Her husband had been asking her to have an abortion, and he made an ultimatum. He said, if you do not have the abortion, I will leave you. She chose over her marriage the child. And as fate would have it, nobody in her extended family could help her. They had so much on their own plates, or they were so unable to see the plight that this young woman was in, that they couldn't react. My grandmother said, "I cannot help Patty. She has made a wrong choice. It is not good. She should have an abortion." My grandmother had 3 abortions in the 30s. You know, illegal, but she had them because she had 2 kids and her husband was selling eggs on the street corner. She did not want more children at this time in her life. So she thought that the decision was clear. Patty had no money. She had a no good husband. She should have an abortion. So she had no pity, no compassion for her granddaughter at all. I was shocked. Here was the loving, laughing, storytelling grandmother being stern. So I said, "Okay, I'll help." I moved into Patty's apartment and got a job at a fancy Italian restaurant where I served all kinds of dishes at tableside and made the money, paid the rent. And one night towards Halloween, I got a call at work saying that Patty had been rushed to the hospital, that she was in danger of dying, and it was almost certain the baby would not be born alive. I didn't know what to do. Here was someone who I'm grown up with, have known my entire life, who's dying. And I'm serving fettuccine puttanesca. It all seems so impossible. And I just found myself starting to pray, saying, "Please, please, allow her to live. Help this baby come into the world. Let them be safe. Please. Please." And at this time, I had just thought prayer was the stupidest thing in the world. And then a year later, I thought so too. But at that moment in my life, when I look back, I see how important it was for me to do something. And the only thing I could do was to say, "Please. Please, help her." Well, they survived. Patty was in the hospital for a week. Giorgio was in an incubator for 6 weeks. He had a respirator. He couldn't breathe. His lungs were not fully developed. And so I was driving them back and forth to the hospital. It was a long journey. But, you know, as I look back on it, my sister once said to me, "I couldn't believe how generous you were." I thought, I wasn't being generous. I was just doing what you would have done or anybody would have done if they could. It wasn't like a choice. It was something that just came out of me. It was like something that I had to do. I never even questioned it once. I thought, okay, I can help. So for 4 months, I did that. Finally, just before Christmas, the baby came home wailing with full power in his lungs, and I was sleeping 10 feet from a wailing baby on a lumpy couch. I thought, wow, what a miracle. What a miracle. So it was a real time for me to begin to assess how little control sometimes you have over events in your life, how you cannot control whether or not Patty is going to live or this child is going to live, but you can ask for help. I found it incredibly comforting. Whenever we are in a realm of willing and choosing, we are confronted with its essential paradox. An authentic expression of our will issues from the wisest parts of ourselves, which is able to recognize our calling to do something true. This truth flows from our truest nature. We can choose not to heed that calling of our true nature, deflect it, fight it, but neither can we rid ourselves of it. It's there. Trauma can blunt it. Enough trauma can bury it. This calling of the inner voice cannot be invented. It is discovered, this gift that lives inside each of you. The choice we are given is whether we choose to live out our calling, no matter what age we are, to live out our calling. Each morning we can choose to accept the challenges that face us with a can-do positive attitude, or screw it, I can't do it, forget it, I give up. Those are the two extremes. But we do have the choice to choose how we approach the beginning of our day. And we have a choice every second that follows. Many times in each day, we are given the opportunity to choose love over hate. We can think the worst about someone or try to find a relationship which is not confrontational, reactive, accusing, blaming, putting someone down, because that just spirals into negativity, as we know. It is very easy to find fault and to blame, often easier than it is to seek out what is potentially good and to find a way to focus that goodness, to cultivate a willingness to work with that goodness. So, as a community of progressive people, our Unitarian Universalist heritage asks us to choose ways of celebrating the diversity of belief that we compromise or that we constitute without diluting its richness, and to always try to find goodness in yourself and other people. This noble path requires us to cultivate courage, real courage, heart courage, mind courage, body courage, an increasing ability to listen to that still small voice within. Harry Scofield believed that wishing and projecting are deeply related to willing and choosing. He believed that we need not get hung up on theological terminology. If we choose to remember that we are concerned with the reality of the good potential, which is in us, developing the power of the will that serves as midwife and nourisher of the good. The following prayer helped him in his long history of social justice. He performed the same-sex civil union in America that we know of in 1955 at the San Francisco Unitarian Church. So he was a pioneer. He fought for civil rights. He was on the front lines of every single human rights cause from the 50s through the 70s. But it's this prayer that helped him. Fix thou our steps, O Lord, that we stagger not at the uneven motions of the world, but go steady on our way, neither censuring our journey for the weather we meet, nor turning aside for anything that befalls us. Where do we find the courage to stay the course, to stay on the good path, a path that is willing to see the goodness in even the most difficult situations? Not to be Pollyannish, not to say that there isn't wrong in the world that needs fixing, because there certainly is, but how do we approach it so that we can be in creative relationship with it instead of a violent battle? Les got a tattoo. He shared with me, he is so lonely sometimes laying there. So lonely. So last week, he got on the computer again and looked for an orthopedic surgeon in the Kansas City area that will take on his back and his hip so that he can walk, so that he can get married again, so that he can fully be alive. But if that doesn't work, he's got his tattoo. And even if it does work, he's got his tattoo. What a brilliant way of proceeding. He's got all bases covered. He wants to get married, but if he can't, he's going to savor every moment anyway. His motto is a good one. Live life now and savor every moment. Not an easy task, I know. But so how do you, as individuals and families and friends, learn to savor the moments that are truly worth savoring and find the ability to savor more moments? Or how do you choose not to do that? Grace.
I'm Grace McMillan. I have a lot of tattoos, and they're actually my mantras, so I thought I'd share them with you because they were very conscious decisions to get. I have a tattoo over here that says faith and one over here that says fate. Yeah. And what those, and there's little birds around them, and what those birds are there to remind me every day I have a choice on how to live my life, and it's not about faith. There's no one in control. It's not about fate. My life hasn't been determined yet, that every day I can consciously choose the way that I'm going to live my life. And then I have more on my wrists, and those are ones for my husband and ones for my children. And they're there so I can always see them, so I can choose compassion and recognize that they're always the most important parts of my life. So I'm all about tattoos as a way to, like, remember, like, you have these visual reminders, like, every day when you're getting ready, every day when you're talking to your loved ones. So I just thought I'd share.
Thanks, Grace.
Oh, Larry Weaver, your talk made me think about when I used to teach the RE program. One of the things that I tried to do was to encourage the kids to notice those things that they did and thought that made them feel good about themselves. Mm. I think that's what you were getting at with the inner you or the core person. And as young people, they're still finding out what makes them feel good about themselves. I'm a good bit older, and I know a lot of things that make me feel good about myself. And you don't always get to choose to do those things or say those things. But when I can choose to do those things, whether it's not putting off some work or it's getting a glass of wine while I'm watching a sunset, doing those things that make me feel more really me those are good choices to make. We can't always make those choices. We don't have the chance to make those choices, but those are good choices to make. Thank you for pushing that.
Jake has a ton of books, and I'm sorry, Marissa Larson. Jake has a ton of books. We're a book family, and one of the books he has is titled something like The Positive Energy Bus, and it's about having a positive attitude about things. And so every morning when Jake and I are driving to school and work, we've made up this silly little song about, you know, we're riding on the positive energy bus today, and we talk about how we're going to have a good day, and while we can't control what things happen to us, we can control how we respond to them.
Could you sing it?
I mean, it's basically just, you know, we're riding the positive energy bus today, and we just kind of chant it as we're driving to school. And then, as Larry said, you know, there are certain things you can't put off doing, but we try to make them fun. So when we're cleaning our house, we put on dance music and things like that, and we make sure that we have goals of, okay, we have to get this done, but as soon as we get this done, then we're going to go and play and have some fun.
Anna Franklin. So the question in the children's story, who are you, really flowed really well into your talk. And thank you for a beautiful talk, Michael. Very inspiring. It brought to mind something that I was doing before I came, which was watching an old video of Dr. John Raymond Christopher, whom some of you may have heard of. I'm a big student of herbology and using herbs for curing and healing. And I hadn't watched any of his videos for a long time, and I was brought back to the realization that Raymond Christopher was an amazing healer. He could use a bulb of garlic, actually, to cure pneumonia in a 2-year-old that the doctors had given up to be dead within the next 12 hours. He did amazing things with plants and herbs. But he also believed in UFOs and believed all these things that I was like, wait a minute, I'm not sure if I can go with that. But the thing that stood out for me was, you know, he was a good man. He was doing what was in front of him to do with his true self, with all his heart in his life, and he was helping people. And whether he was an atheist or a born-again Christian or whatever he was or believed in UFOs was not the important thing. The important thing was that his heart was in what he was doing, and he was helping people in a very positive way, and he devoted his whole life to it until he died. So,
thank you, Anna.
Hi, Sarah Lott. So as a person of in their mid-20s, I often have a really hard time answering the question, who are you? and because of that, sometimes I find myself having a really hard time making decisions, choosing, because, you know, finding that inner self and finding what's the best choice, and I'll get stuck sometimes. And one of these times, Alex did something that really, really helped. We went out to Kanza, the Overlook, and we were just looking at the prairie and talked about just looking at the grass. You know, the wind was blowing, the grass was blowing down. You know, sometimes, you know, it'd fall all the way to the ground, but it would come right back up. And what actually brought that back up? It has roots that holds you, that held it into the ground, connections that were being made around it. And so I try to now remember those connections. You know, your definition of humility was spot on for me. And, you know, feeling those connections around you. I mean, could just be to people, but, you know, to the world around you, and trusting that there's something there that can pull you forward. So.
Thank you, Sarah. Barbara.
I have a problem with prayer. And you said you prayed. Being an atheist, I have never figured out to whom I should pray. You know, do I pray to the school board that my kids would get better grades? Do I pray to the car dealer that I can find a car for Sarah? Who did you pray to?
I think that it's an undistinguished entity of unnameable, and all I knew is that I needed to do something. And so I yielded to that impulse. And whether it helped Patty and Giorgio or not, I have no idea, and I wouldn't make any such claim. But what I know it did for me is it connected me directly to their situation, their danger, and I was riding the wave with them in a way that I couldn't have if I was just purely intellectualizing it. And it's not wrong to intellectualize it either, but there is a heart component to catastrophe which you need to allow to be involved with the experience. So it's often when things are really tough that I find myself, oh, help me, you know, and who am I saying that to? I am not sure. But all I know is that it helps me. It connects me to something beyond my own inability to take care of something. And, of course, the clearest example of that was when Charles was struck dead, and I found him dead, and I said, no, God. And I said, where the heck did that come from later on? No, God, you cannot have him. So there is this impulse in me to respond that way when there is no choice, when doubt is a luxury, when you go straight after for what you want. So that's the power I try to tap into, and I'm not making a claim of God or nature spirits or anything. I'm just putting my desire out into the world in such a way that it connects me. So that's probably not a good answer, but that's my answer.
That's an interesting question of, you know, if you're an atheist, who to pray to? You know, how do you connect with that? I believe it's possible that we all have as humanity, have a collective consciousness that we can tap into. And when you were, you know, when you were involved in that situation with those people, well, then you were part of their life. And you could, I think there's kind of a collective consciousness that humanity has, and we can tap into that. Don't necessarily have to call it God. I don't know if anybody understands what I'm trying to say. But
well, Harry Schofield said that if you have a problem with the word prayer, think of it as your deepest wish, your most sincere yearning in life. That's the source you tap into to make that relevant, to lift it up out of the subconscious into the conscious so that it may have more room in your life.
Can you hear me okay? Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know if I'm out of line here, but there's a whole bunch of people in Metal Arc. Can you hear me okay now?
Yeah.
A bunch of people in Metal Arc, and especially the memory units, I think they're dying of loneliness. Does anyone ever visit them, like once every 6 months? Someone from some church or any kind of church ever just come by and say hello or something, bring them a gift, something like that? I think they're dying of loneliness. It's kind of a scary place. My mom had a bad reaction to anesthesia, and I think Ms. Oldfather visited her a couple times, and I really appreciate that. But she had a bad reaction to anesthesia, but finally her head cleared up and we got her out of there. But I think these people are dying of loneliness. People don't die of heart attacks. They die of broken hearts. You know, it's kind of a scary place. And Les is over there. He's not in the memory unit, but I could see where a lot of those people at Metal Arc are just, no one visits them. They got nothing to live for, you know.
Luckily, they have a generally caring staff.
What's that?
Luckily, they generally have a caring staff.
I think they do, and I think they're overworked, and I think they're trying. But right. I don't know, do any of the churches in town ever just send someone over there once every month or two or 6 months? I don't know. Well, I know you guys in the ministry overworked, but...
Ministers do go to people
really?
That are connected to the congregations they serve.
Yeah.
So that's what I do.
Yeah.
So.
I don't know.
All right, we have time for Alex and maybe one more.
I think this question of prayer when you're a non-deist, not necessarily atheist, but someone who just doesn't see connection to the idea of God is really important. And that's part of the reason I really like the Amon poem when I pulled up in before Michael, because I found the idea of faith and the idea of kind of trust and stuff through Buddhism, for the very reason that it's deliberately both non-deist and it acknowledges both impulses. And part of why I took Sarah up to the overlook over Kanza to do that little bit of faith and prayer and the world around us, and how I choose to act out and pray and to acknowledge my impulse to need that kind of affirmation of my wishes, right, in the world, is to recognize that, like, when you invest into the world, it invests back in you. And so prayer is an act of investing your emotions, your ideas, your impulses into the world to kind of assuage that fear. And that's how I think about prayer. And so maybe that helps further this conversation.
Well, I think the other thing that Harry would say to Barbara is that prayer is also action. It's doing the right thing. So if you have a problem with the school board, or the school board needs to address an issue, then you be a part of the positive process of making change. It's not just about sitting around thinking, oh, everything is good, or I wish everything were better. No, you have to act. Act is a part of, in his understanding of his work with sacred text, was an aspect of prayer. It's action. It's allowing it to move outside of the imagination into reality.
Hi, I'm Renee. When I got my tattoo, it's a Star Trek tattoo, and before I got it, I had all these ideas about what it would mean to me, and kind of like hope for the future, and an optimistic outlet, and stuff, things like that. And then when I actually got it, I had this moment where I was looking at it, and I was really struck by the idea about how that would be there after what makes me is gone, you know? And I had this profound sense of mortality that I wasn't expecting. And it was actually really meaningful to me, and it wasn't a negative thing at all. I felt kind of connected to other people in the sense of just a sense of oneness, I guess, with that everyone has to face that. And it kind of made me feel, sometimes I get frustrated, and it's like, how have we existed so long as a species and still have these problems that seem to be like no-brainers? Like, it should be okay for people to love each other and things like that, and we shouldn't be killing each other all the time. It seems like a bad idea, and it seems like simple concepts that have taken a long time to progress to where we are now. But then I think about how it's all over so fast, you know, and how I don't accomplish what I want each day, but I try, and I think everybody's trying. And I felt kind of this general sense of compassion that I don't think was like a cop-out or anything like that, but just kind of feeling compassion for, like, our history as a species, I guess, in general as well. So,
thank you very much.
So thank you for a great conversation. I think we're engaging a lot of challenging questions, right, which is what this space is for. So to celebrate a little bit how we're challenging those questions as a community, I'd like you to open up to our closing hymn, which is 318. 318, 318, in the blue book.
Thank you for singing with us. I have some kind of last words to as we go forth, and this positive outlook and affirmation to remember that, as Walt Whitman notes in his Leaves of Grass, not I or anyone else can travel the road for you. You must travel it by yourself. Is not far, it is within reach. Perhaps you've been on it since you were born and did not know. Perhaps it is everywhere on water and land. Hope you go forth and have faith and coffee and enjoyment of our community. Thank you.